Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, coming up at the Jane Bond in Waterloo, Ontario on Sunday, September 28th, my wife's birthday. Maybe I should take her out. Steve Parkinson and the Stony Lonesome are performing at the Jane Bond, located at 005 Princess Street in Waterloo. And at the nearby Starlight Social Club on Wednesday, October 1st, Electric Six are performing. And then the following night, Thursday, October 2nd, Always are playing with special guest Heat. Some good shows coming up in Waterloo. The Starlight Social Club is located at 47 King Street in Waterloo, and as I mentioned earlier, the Jane Bond is at 005 Princess Street. You can learn more about each venue at starlightsocialclub.ca and janebond.ca. Two of the best venues to see music in Southern Ontario. Go check them out.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Hey, sorry that the schedule for the show seems a little out of whack lately, but it's been a little busy around here, and I haven't been able to do the show as regularly, and I'm also thinking maybe once a week is enough. Don't you? A couple of people have told me, man, like, the show is cool, but I can't keep up. And that's fine. I understand. I don't know. I'm just making as much as I can. I don't know. I have no schedule, really. Sometimes it's once a week. You've seen it. Sometimes it's four times a week. It depends how I'm feeling. Anyway, I hope you're cool with it. Now, I was all weirded out this week, at least the show has been, because I hosted the Aux broadcast of the Polaris Music Prize Gala on Monday, and then I was in Toronto Tuesday. And it was fun. I had a good time. It was chaos, but I'd like to thank the Aux people for asking me. I enjoy the chaos. I outwardly complain about the chaos, but I think I secretly quite like it. It's very relaxing in a way. It's not as intense a thing, you know, to be on web TV with no net. And they're just like, well, whatever happens. I'm like, okay, if you say so. And it's fun. So thanks to Sam and Ashley and Nicole and everybody who makes me feel like I know what I'm doing when I do that thing. And I hope you enjoyed seeing me. It's still online if you want to watch me stumble about at the Polaris thing, Polaris Music Prize thing. It was fun. Tanya Tagak won, former guest, one-time guest on the show. So I was pleased. It was good. It was a fun time. Anyway, on Tuesday, while I was in Toronto, I connected with my, I guess she's my friend. She's someone whose work I really admire. Christine Fellows from Winnipeg, Manitoba, has a new poetry book an album. They complement one another. It's called Burning Daylight, and she just released it this week, and I'm a big fan, so we went and had lunch at a place in Toronto, and you'll hear about that now, and you'll hear some songs and pieces from this poetry music collection, and that's the show. And and closest I think I've come to crying on this show ever. I didn't think I would cry. I don't cry. I cried when, actually you'll find out, one of the last times I cried on this episode. And I did cry when I was dumped. But that's, I think, supposed to. I was just, yeah. Why am I telling you this? Just as me and Christine Fellows, you won't cry. I almost cried. You'll be fine. You'll be just fine. Creative Control. This episode is brought to you by Pizza Trocadero, the finest pizzeria in all of Guelph, Ontario. They've got delicious gourmet pizzas, or choose from an array of fresh ingredients and make whatever you like. Calzones, wings, panzerotti, salads, breadsticks, garlic bread. Pizza Trocadero has it all. You can find them at 7 Municipal Street in Guelph or visit them online at trocaderoguelph.ca. That's TrocaderoGuelph.ca. Call them at 519-829-2444 for pickup or delivery. That's Pizza Trocadero, a place of the good trade.
In the middle of the night, I will take my leave the way I come. In a gunny sack, drug over Chilkoot Pass, I stayed for the wild blue iris, hemlock, and the devil's club. For the glowing coals of burning daylight.
Okay, can you first of all tell me your name and the name of this place?
So my name is Kyle. You're here at Milagro Mercer, just on the corner of John and Mercer. It's a Mexican cantina, so we have pretty much anything authentic that you can think of from Mexico. We have it here in the cuisine, and it tastes great. It tastes really good.
All right, Kyle, I appreciate that. Now, Christine Fellows, do you know what you're having yet? Have you decided?
I have decided. I made a decision.
Absolutely.
So, because I'm a vegetarian.
Yes.
And I notice it says that there's vegetarian options available, yes.
Right. So I can...
Can you do the enchiladas vegetarian?
Yes. So under vegetarian, we have a couple sauces that I can recommend.
Okay.
Rojas, which is like a tomato sauce, is a little bit on the spicier side,
yeah,
but still very tasty.
Yes.
Where Tacuba is like a green sauce that's on the milder side, more sour than it is spicy.
Okay.
As far as veggies go, those are the two options that you have for enchiladas. Tacos, I can also get you a vegetarian taco. I know it's not on the menu,
okay,
but we can get that for you if you like as well.
Okay. And it's
secret menu items.
Yes. Secret menu.
That's pretty special.
I know.
It's good to know someone here, for sure. Okay. Those are your basic.
And the tacos are, they're corn tortillas, right?
Corn.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll have vegetarian tacos. Lay it on me.
That's a good trip.
I made a switch up.
That was good.
Last minute switch up.
Sometimes you would be known as a difficult customer in some,
yes,
circumstances. No?
Never here. We don't have difficult customers here. We always try.
No, I know I'm difficult.
I like this guy.
I know.
He's good, yeah.
He's also very handsome.
You're a good looking guy.
You're easy on the eyes.
La Perla? Is that how you say that?
La Perla, absolutely. A little habanero sauce. It's spicy if you like it.
Can I get like a mild? I got a thing. I can't take. I know I look Indian. I am Indian. I can't handle like crazy spices.
Serious?
I like Indian food, but for some reason, other things like it gets to me. I don't know. Whatever. Just do your thing.
I'll let the kitchen know. Absolutely, no problem. Okay. So La Perla and taco vegetarian. Anything to start? Guacamole and chips or
some guac?
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kyle.
Fresh every single day.
Awesome.
Oh, nice.
Thank you. This is great. This was a good choice. You just saw this walking by the.
Yeah,
street?
And it's weird that I had been here before, but I didn't realize that this was the place that I had been before.
Now, what would have brought you to this neck of the woods? CBC's nearby.
No, we were doing that show, Everything Under the Moon, at the Harbourfront Center,
Oh, okay. Which
probably you didn't go to.
Was that a thing with Sherry?
Yeah, me and Sherry Boyle.
Yeah.
And we were looking for a place where we could bring everyone for an after the show thing. And you know how Toronto, it's like rammed full. Every place is rammed full. So we came here, and it was great because we could fit like 15 people.
I find this area, so just so people who don't know Toronto, we're kind of near what, like the Rogers Center and the CBC. We're like...
in the terrible zone.
It's a weird zone. It's like a businessy zone.
Yeah.
Like front John area. And what did he say? Mercer? I didn't even know. We're on the corner. Oh, yeah, that's Mercer. Yeah. Anyway. So because I used to work in this area for years, there's just not a lot of good stuff to eat. I don't want to blame anyone or fault anyone, but I found that it was hard to get good food.
Yes, I agreed. My parents were staying here a lot last year because my mom was coming into town for, she was doing radiation treatments.
Oh.
How delightful.
Yeah.
And so they were staying down here all the time, and it was it was crazy. It was a problem. You think, because a lot of people that go and do treatments at that hospital stay right down here, and there is not like one healthy option within walking distance.
Yeah, I would. How's your mom doing?
She's doing great.
Oh, good. Awesome. Good. I had a bike when I worked here, so I would just bike up to the streets that I liked with the food, like Bloor and College, where I thought the real food was. Am I being snobby?
Yeah, you're being a little snobby. Bloor and College.
Those are not like amazing food streets, but I just would go. I just also, for the exercise, you work at a desk job, just get on a bike, go. I like working for my meal a little bit. Sweating it a little bit, just getting out there and, you know.
Well, and this is a great city for biking, even though I know it's dangerous, but it is like, as they go,
it's bikeable.
It's bikeable. It's way easier.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Mm-hmm. So you're in Toronto on tour behind your new project.
Well, it's not technically on tour. I just came here to do a book launch, which I've never done before. And we're just doing one in Winnipeg, and then actually we'll start touring it in January because the album has a sort of winter theme. So I thought it'd be a great idea to bring it back to the place that inspired it.
Oh.
So we're going to the Yukon.
Oh, wow.
With the trio, with me and the two cellists, ladies.
Who's in the band?
It's me and Alex McMaster. She's from here, from Toronto. She plays cello and trumpet and clarinet and sings beautifully. And Leanne Zacharias, who I've played with for, I don't know, since she was 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Cradle robber that I am. And she plays cello also and sings. And so it's the three of us.
Right.
Yeah.
And is that the configuration on the record?
Yes, yes.
I was thinking about, and the record is called Burning Daylight.
Yes.
And I was thinking as I was listening to it that among your recent records, it's a fairly sparse affair. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah, we tried to do it. I actually recorded it here in Toronto, and we did most of it live off the floor. So, and it was sort of arranged with the idea in mind that it would be something that we could perform live as well, although there are secretly, like, lots of overdubs.
Little, okay. But I think I'm thinking of poppier. You've made some really, like, pop.
Yeah.
Orchestrated pop records, I'd say. Like, a lot of layers. And this one has a sparseness and a directness to it that I just haven't heard you do in a while, maybe.
Well, it was the no drums thing. The no drums was a big thing. And, you know, like, it's a weird... Once you enter that world, you have to really commit to it because drums and electric instruments fill up holes and things, and when you take all of that away, it's scary. It's a bit scary.
You found it scary?
Oh yeah, because it's just like you have to do everything right, sort of like the first or second or third time, and then if you don't do it right, then it's kind of like, well,
that's true. When you're recording a song with a drummer, usually the way things go these days, unless you're doing something really live off the floor, that it's really up to the drummer not to screw up that first or second take. Or not first or second take, but that bed track, you usually build everything on top of a good solid drum track.
Yeah, and it's safety. You've got a little safety net there, you know, of something to ride on top of. And with us, we did use a click track. If you're interested in the boring,
I wasn't, but now I am.
No, but it is a weird thing. I know some people are like anti click track, but just the structure of some of the pieces that required it, and it was just easy for us to have something. Those two women are amazing musicians, so they can live in that world and it not adhere to it, not listen to the click track, but play just with it in the background.
Right. Now, the record and the poetry book, these are complimentary pieces, right?
Yeah.
And they were inspired by a certain writer?
Yeah, Jack London. Are you not a fan?
I know I'm not. I don't actually know his work that well. I know a little bits about Jack London, and you were inspired. But he's a guy that wrote about kind of gold rush stuff, Klondike kind
of
stuff.
He wrote about a lot of things, but one of he was, I think, probably best known for the Klondike stuff that he wrote. And he was turn of the 20th century, so he just happened to go up to the Yukon with, I think it was his brother-in-law that was going up and needed somebody to kind of help him because he had to carry a certain amount of gear over there. They wouldn't let you in if you didn't bring a certain amount of stuff. And he was just a really curious soul. So he went with no idea of trying to strike it rich. He didn't have the gold fever, you know, he just went.
Almost like an observer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is that but at the time of his death, he was probably one of the
wealthiest.
Best known and wealthiest writers.
Yeah.
Like he actually... struck gold from his writing instead of, because he made no money up in the Yukon. And
yeah, he made a fortune. He died like at 40 years old. He died very young, I thought. Yeah, which might have been par for the course at that time.
Given. No, he was a bit of, he lived hard. And
oh,
he
did he?
Lived okay. hard and, yeah.
He was accused of like plagiarism and stuff?
His life was fraught with everything, but he did crazy stuff like sailed the South Seas and he traveled the world at a time when people didn't travel the world and he was a really extreme. He was like an extreme kind of person in the world, but he also had that weird work ethic where he wrote 1,000 words a day. Like he would force himself, and it was early on in his life. He grew up very poor and he was trying to make a living as a writer, which is also something that I was interested in, this idea of someone that saw writing as a way out of poverty, you know? Whereas we don't generally think of that like that now.
Not really, no. I mean, it happens in rare cases, but yeah. So were there specific pieces of his that resonated with you?
Yeah, the sort of central story that I was kind of working from was that, and it's a masterpiece of short fiction. It's that story, To Build a Fire.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's
I haven't read it. I'll be frank. I don't, as far as I know, I've not read any Jack London. Should I have encountered him at school or something?
Maybe Call of the Wild. Some kids read Call of the Wild and White Fang, which are kind of...
White Fang, I know. Like, I know that stuff, but
maybe
I don't...
Maybe read, but saw the movie. There was movie adaptations.
I know the names. But I can't say that I've read it personally. I'm trying to be honest with you.
Yeah,
most
no,
people
you should.
In this position would lie and say, oh, yeah, I read it 50 times. But no, I don't think I've read his stuff.
Well, maybe you will one day when you're up in Olecta. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
That looked beautiful.
Thanks, Kyle.
Do you like to get the crunch on that?
Mm-hmm.
How is it?
It was good.
Is it?
I just had the first chip. I'm a little hungry.
Are you?
Did you eat?
I haven't eaten yet today.
Not. It's like 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
I know.
That's not healthy.
I know. You know, I'm traveling. It's hard.
This isn't my fault. I was late for our interview.
No, it's perfectly fine. It's okay. A beautiful day.
It is a nice day. No, it's good. You should try the guac.
Right on.
Anyway, sorry. You were saying something about a very specific story that...
Yeah, To Build a Fire. So it's
build
the... It's just basically about a guy freezing to death on the trail. He's walking, going by foot up in the Yukon, trying to go by foot from A to B. And I guess the inherent lesson in the story is don't travel alone.
Yeah.
So, and we all know that. All good Canadians in the wilderness, you know, you have your sort of things you go by. But it's just a masterful piece of work, and I guess I was reading it to my husband John when we were up in Dawson City, and it was February.
Oh, okay.
We did that residency, the songwriters residency, where they bring the songwriters up in February.
Right, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
What was it like in February?
Well, and we're from Winnipeg, right? Like, we know the cold, and we brought our big parkas with us, and it was, like, there was ice fog. It was unbelievably cold when we were there. Minus 46 was the warmest it was.
Do people go out and do stuff in that weather?
People do go out and do stuff. We saw, you know, people dog sledding and, you know, living their life. I mean, it's not as populated up in Dawson in the winter time, obviously. But John was doing curling clinics and stuff while he was there. So, and it's one of those outdoor, like it's natural ice. On that curling rink, so it was kind of, which is a rare thing. Curlers really get excited about that when it's natural ice. I don't know.
I don't know much about.
Oh, well.
I mean, a natural anything over a synthetic or fabricated thing must be nice, I assume, and so.
Yeah, but it was intense, and we traveled a lot we toured also as part of that residency, so we went up to Old Crow, which is only flyable, and most people, even Yukoners, don't go there because it's insanely expensive to fly
Did
there.
Did you fly in rickety planes?
I wouldn't call them rickety.
I flew in a rickety plane.
Did you? The one from Whitehorse to Dawson?
Yeah, the Whitehorse to Dawson run was pretty rickety. It was pretty nerve-wracking.
I think it can be very... sorry for the crunching.
I approve and promote the crunching on the air. People love hearing people eat food.
Really?
No. I don't know. Some people are probably like, I'm getting hungry. I hope everyone listening breaks out a bowl of guacamole and chips.
Oh, yeah. You know what, though? Avocado, you just can't go wrong with avocado.
Yeah, it's good. I'm having trouble getting some on this chip. There we go. It's really good.
It is quite good. I made a good choice.
We make a lot of good choices. Okay. So, was this Burning Daylight stuff something that came out of your time as a songwriter in residence in Dawson City, or did it precede it?
Well, it was before I went up there. I knew I wanted to use the time, and it was right at the perfect time for me. I had finished the previous project, had just finished recording it, I think. Yeah, and so I was on my way up just kind of thinking about it, and I had two ideas, the seeds for the two projects that I did, Everything Under the Moon, the one I was telling you about where we came here to this place after party. I had the vision for that, the first image for that, and for Burning Daylight as well. And like Everything Under the Moon. What are you doing?
Sorry, I can't eat. Yeah, Everything Under the Moon.
Yeah, but Everything Under the Moon happened in 2012.
Okay.
And then this took a little... a couple detours.
So you're basing it, it's at least in, how is it, what is the connection to Jack London's work?
Well, in my idea, maybe it won't translate like this, if so, for anybody who's listening to it, but in my idea, I wanted to respond to that story, and I wanted to, I mean, much of the writing, his writing, and the writing of the time was around the Gold Rush, was much, very much centered around the camaraderie of men. And women were these, you know, they lived around the perimeters. And actually, there's a really great book that I found when I was up there called Women of the Klondike by Frances Backhouse.
Okay.
Which basically just, she went and kind of, it's a feminist retelling of the Gold Rush. And it's fascinating. Like, they, all the people that ended up in that place were fascinating,
oh, wow.
Really.
Oh, we already have our food.
Tacos.
Do a thing. Great, thanks.
Thank you. That looks beautiful.
Thank you so much. Look at that. I don't know how we're going to... We picked finger food. This isn't knife and fork food, so this is going to be...
Well, maybe we could do the thing where we...
We want to take a break and
take
eat
a break
bit?
And then eat and then come
okay,
back.
Okay, well, so where were we talking about before we take the break?
I don't remember. I was blabbing.
Can we play a song from the record?
Yeah.
Why don't we do that? We'll take a break.
Sure.
Play a song from the record, and then we'll eat, and then we'll come back.
Yes.
What's the song?
Oh, On the Spot. What's a good song? Why don't we do listen to Build a Fire, which is sort of named for the Jack London story we were just talking about.
Build a Fire.
To Build a Fire, yeah.
To Build a Fire. Okay. We'll hear that. We'll eat. We'll
it's a bit of
back.
A bummer. It's not really food, eating, music.
That's fine. I'm not going to hear it.
Okay.
I'm just going to eat my tacos. We'll let the people hear it.
Okay.
We'll be back with more with Christine Fellows, but this is To Build a Fire from the new album, Burning Daylight. Okay.
On this winter morning... Wake up above the tree line in the dark, shivering. On this winter night, you will sleep dreamless underneath a canopy of stars, wherever you are, wherever you are. To build a fire, oh, to build a fire, oh, to build a fire. On this lonely mountain, to watch the snow creep down into the valley, you stumble and fall. On this lonely mountain, you will lie face up, waiting for the fire to subside, shivering. Oh, to build a fire.
I'm pretty full.
Oh my god, I'm stuffed.
That
so
was
good.
You didn't even, like I gotta say.
I know, I'm just...
You're not done.
I think, I'm done for now. Just gonna relax. Talk about budgies.
Now, we were just talking about budgies, and you... What happened? You recently acquired a budgie named Pickles?
Well, we named him Pickle.
Why'd you name the budgie Pickles? Green?
He's green.
Yeah.
Is that weird? Well, we...
No, my budgie was green, and I named him Buddy.
Well, we were gonna call him Flappy.
Flappy?
But, which is also obvious, but... It was too close to the dog's name, so anytime we would be talking to the budgie, the dog, everybody would come.
What was the dog? What's the dog's name?
Lefty and Lucy. So
Lefty and Lucy. Lefty, Flappy. Yeah, I can see that.
It's too. They were. Everyone was confused, so we were like, we have to choose a name that has no relation.
Pickles.
Pickles. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
He's the greatest. No, he just flew like out of the sky and literally onto my arm, mm-hmm. in my yard. So now we have this, and I've never been a. I love birds. I think they're amazing, and I'm a total avid birder, but I'd never thought about living with one in my house. And then you were just telling me about Buddy.
So I had a budgie named Buddy that I had from when I was 9 to 19, I guess, something like that.
That's extraordinary.
And some of your friends when you're a kid, they have dogs and whatever, and you have a budgie. And then if you're me, you kind of go on about how great your budgie is, and people don't...
Would you? And they wouldn't believe you because they think it's...
No, I mean, yeah. I had another friend who had a budgie, too, and they didn't care that much about their budgie. But I, like, Buddy was cool. And I taught him to say his name. Like, I'd go, like, Buddy, Buddy, Buddy. And he'd go, like, Buddy, Buddy, Buddy. Like, he would repeat after me. And I would sing the Crowded House song, You Better Be Home Soon, to him. And he would fall asleep.
Do you
want
to do a little...
That's what... No, I'm not going to do it. Anyway, I had a much better voice before the stuff. I got older, and I would sing these songs to him, and we'd play. So one of the things we would do, I tried to explain this to you before about baths. There's a few things that you were... Because you were just like, how do budgies work?
I don't... And I'm learning. They apparently like mirrors.
Oh, love mirrors. And they will glom on to the personality of the person they love the most. And so Buddy would every morning go nuts when he heard one of the family come downstairs. Usually my mom would be down first.
And did you put the cloth over
over him in the cage?
Did you make it go dark as night in there, or did you just...
White cloth.
White is fine.
I thought it was just a white cloth. I don't know why we did that. Same kind of weird, like no air.
I know, that's why I worry about it, but he seems to, he's in there.
I think we were told to do it or something.
So maybe it's an urban myth. Maybe it's one of those things no one knows why.
I think it's to keep them warm.
Oh, really?
I think so, because it's, we get into blankets, and we're not in the open air. Like, if you went, they're they can't be too cold, birds, budgies.
I never thought about that.
I think it's to keep them warm. So it's not necessary to be like, you are sensory deprived. Not a sensory deprivation thing. It's just like, it's cold. So we'd put like a cloth on him. But anyway, my mom would let him out, and he'd be like chirping when he heard it was coming down the stairs. And he would immediately, like, fly to the three little, like, chandelier-style lights my parents have, chirping his head off until he heard my voice. And I'd be like, Buddy! Like, I'd just woken up because he'd wake me up. And he would fly onto my comforter and my blanket, and he would, like, by my feet. And he would just waddle his way up and then kiss me on the nose. And he loved me. It's because I saved his life. My sister sat on him.
That's right.
I told you this story, but my sister sat on him. And he had one leg on either side of a couch cushion, and so his body went into the crack, but his leg stayed up. And at one point, we didn't know. At one point, I just said, "Hey, Anita, where's Buddy?" And she's like, "I don't know. Maybe he's upstairs. I'll go look." So she hopped up, and I was watching TV, and out of the corner of my eye, I just saw like, thump, like I heard the sound, and Buddy just like launched himself. He was under this woman's ass, this small girl's ass, in a couch, and he just popped himself up. Land on the ground, flapped and flapped, and I picked him up and I looked at him. He was breathing very heavily and just looking at me like, dude, that was the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I'm a budgie. I'm not supposed to be sat on. And I his legs were all pried up, and I had to pull them out from his body, save his life. And
then, I don't understand how that... I don't understand the leg thing.
I don't know what to tell you. I was a kid. And I called my dad at work after it happened to be like, Dad, like I was...
Yeah, what do I do?
10 or 11. Like, Dad, what the hell? Like, Buddy got sat on. Like, he's hurt. But by the time my dad got there, I had done it. I just instinctively pulled his legs out from his... They were kind of... As I say, they were beside his breast.
Oh, like my God.
You know what I mean? Like he looked like a DeLorean.
Oh, my God.
Like, he had two sets of wings. So I had to pull them out. anyway, from that point on, I was his favorite guy. I saved his life, and he would come and kiss me and stuff, and he would eat sometimes. They're a little gross because they poo everywhere.
Yes, I've noticed that.
But the poo...
But if you take your glasses off, you don't see it.
No. The thing about the poo, I'll tell you about the budgie poo. You got to get it. As soon as you see it land, this is probably gross. But as a kid, I would just... My finger. It's just like in one clump. If everything's going...
It's a little gross.
It is gross, but I would just... I wouldn't eat it or anything. I just like to dispose of it. If you put your... If you gently tap it, it just... The whole clump sticks to your finger, and then you go and wash it off and... Then you eat a sandwich or whatever you're going to do. But he would eat my cereal. He would perch on the bowl of my cereal bowl, and he would drink the milk. And if
are they allowed to eat dairy?
It depends on the diet. I don't think they're lactose intolerant. I think they just do what they do. He would nip at it, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, at the time, was eating horrible cereal, so he liked the chocolate milk, I think, and the cereal would... And occasionally he would fall in, and he would just be covered in this, like, S'mores Graham's gunk. But he would take baths. If you take him in the shower, like if you go and take a shower and you have your glass of, we would have a glass of water and he would bathe in the water. He loved it. They're the best. I miss my buddy. He was the best.
Did you ever take him outside?
No.
Never,
no.
Ever.
No, never.
They're not to
That's
go outside.
Big, no, in fact, it sounds like you inherited
somebody
a wayward budgie.
Yeah.
And that's not good. No, they don't survive. It's not. No, you can't.
Although we took him to the Humane Society, we did our due diligence before we adopted Pickles. But when we took him to the Humane Society, they said that budgies, in fact, can fly quite long distances.
Well, I'm sure they can, but I don't think that they are such a tiny.
Yeah.
They are prey. Like they're built. They're a beautiful.
Yes.
I think if you were a bird of prey, you'd be like, that is amazing, and I am going to kill that and eat it or chase it for sport because it's just so adorable. You know, I'm happy you have Pickles. That's great.
What color was Buddy?
He was green.
Oh, he's a green one with the yellow head.
We're a good
cop. That's great.
Yeah, thank you. We're just gonna chat some more. Okay. Yeah.
It's green. So, did he have blue tail?
He had a dark blue tail, and they said that you could tell if it was male or female by the spots. I think
they told us that he was a male at the end, but they didn't tell us how they determined that.
I think it has. We can look this up, but I think it's spots on their face or something.
Yeah, he has little blue specks.
Yeah.
He's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me.
It's pretty remarkable. I think dog and cat people, and I'm a cat guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a cat named Gary. He's awesome, too. I like pets. I like animals. But, yeah, birds are magical. I think that people...
I have no idea.
I know. They are messy. Like, if you get into, like, parrots and stuff, like, that shit is... brutal. Like, I can't imagine that flying around your house, just having these bird shit everywhere.
Yeah.
But he, as I say, the budgie doo-doo is pretty manageable. I would also use Kleenex. I wouldn't just use my fingers. But you dab it. It's a dab and gone.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I found. And then if you don't get at it, because if they go up into your curtain rods and then they leave a little...
Yeah.
It's gross, but at least you can... It's not the grossest that you can get it out.
Well, I figure dogs are pretty gross. We have a couple pretty gross dogs, so...
I like that you're an animal person.
It's a bit insane over there right now. There's like, we live in a tiny house, a very small house with two giant dogs and now a budgie.
Yeah, now the budgie. And are the animals getting along?
Well, one of our dogs is quite old, so he's just pretty chill. He just kind of, you know, takes it in stride. But the other one is deeply curious, and she's also obsessed with tennis balls. And Pickles and a tennis ball are very similar in sort of...
Yeah, keep an eye on that situation. Yeah. That's not good. But I think they'll learn.
I hope so. Yeah, we're hoping. But it's like, I had no idea.
Pickles flies free.
I just monitored periodically. Most of the time he's in his house, but I bring him out.
You gotta let it out of the cage.
Well, the thing is, they clipped his wings at the Humane Society, and apparently that's what they do.
He can't fly?
He can sort of fly, but he land, like he...
Why do they clip the wings?
Apparently that's what they do.
When a wayward... Bird is brought in?
Yeah, because they'll grow back.
Oh.
Apparently they grow back. It just takes like 6 months or something.
Oh, okay.
And by that time, hopefully whoever has adopted it would understand.
I guess they can't have these birds flying everywhere. Or like,
I know, but...
trying to fly everywhere.
I wish they hadn't. Yeah, we were sad about that. That was kind of one of
those
things.
I didn't realize they came back like that.
Yeah, but he does... He was pretty... he was pretty traumatized when he first showed up. But it only took him a couple of days.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, listeners of your podcast.
Yeah.
It is worthwhile looking into this as if you want to have a pet. Maybe you have a small kid.
Yeah.
That and you're not sure if you want to commit to a large
they're
animal.
They're called lovebirds. Like, they're very social and forthcoming. That, like, they're cool. I like them that way. It's good. Do you write about, have you written about, you've written songs about birds, haven't you?
A few.
I feel like you've written a few songs about birds.
A few, yes. Most of my songs are about birds. But I didn't ever think about having one living in my house. I thought it was weird, and it isn't weird at all. It's wonderful.
There's not many, like, because I know that at various points in your, you've mentioned a vague fascination, at least, well, not a vague, you've been fascinated by spinsters in the past, too, and, like, I assume that there are spinsters who surround themselves with animal life, and birds would be a good spinster animal.
Well, I think so. I think Marianne Moore, who is one of the people that I wrote a lot about her work, she's an American poet, a spinster, a well-known spinster, wore a big cape and a tricorn hat, the whole nine yards, but she had an alligator in her bathtub at a certain point.
Whoa.
She was extreme in the pet department.
Yeah, that's weird.
She liked weird animals.
Okay, so there's an that's interesting. You isolate yourselves from, I mean, if you take the idea of a spinster at the general sort of perception of a spinster of kind of isolating yourself from other people, but surrounding yourself with alligators or other weird animals, that's kind of, so there's, yeah, that's
weird. Well, there's something amazing about being able to communicate to a creature that is non-verbal, but communicate so well. And I feel like that even when, you know, when I'm alone with the animals in the house and John is away.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I feel like I have a really rich social.
Yeah.
Social, like, our house is full. It's still, yes, there's one person missing, but it's still, there's a lot going on. It doesn't have that.
Gary comes, my cat comes and sees me when I'm working in my office all the time just to be like, hey, you're good? I'm like, yeah, I'm good. Thanks, buddy.
We had our cats, when we had cats, ours have perished, but we had the thing where they would sit on the computer laptop until it turned blue. You know, the screen goes blue and then you have to take it to the store and they have to do something to it?
No, I never had. No, Gary's
they like good. It because it's hot.
Oh, I never thought of that.
Never leave your laptop open with a cat around.
No, Gary wouldn't do that. Gary's a good boy. Gary's a good boy. I like Gary. Gary, I've been lucky. I think I've been pretty lucky with my pets over the years. And they just sort of came to me in weird ways. Anyway.
Yeah, Buddy sounds extraordinary.
Buddy was great. He died the day I got back from my first semester of university for the Christmas break. I kind of checked in with my parents during exams. They said, yeah, he's sick. He needs to go to the vet. So we took him. I think I came home to take him to the vet. And then, no, I got home from university. We took him to the vet. And they said, yeah, he's probably got a tumor.
Wow.
There's nothing you can really do.
Did they euthanize him? Or did he?
No.
He just came home and.
No, he stuck around. Like, I got home and he seemed happy to see me as much as he could in his condition. And I went to sleep, and I went to bed, rather, and I just heard a thump. And I went down, and my good friend had died.
I'm so sorry. And he was just
staring, you know, he's lying on his poo-covered newsprint, and his eyes were wide open, and it sucked. And I cried. It's probably, I was like 19, and I cried.
Oh, God.
Over a budgie. But and people laugh.
No, it doesn't matter.
I love that guy. He was the best guy.
So did you have a funeral? What did you guys do?
No. Some Hindu ritual was kind of done. It was winter, but I think we did a thing. I just sort of followed my parents' lead. I think he was in a river. He was sort of deposited in a river. He wasn't buried anywhere. And that's something you do. So he floated down a river and it's gone.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, it was, it's weird. I'm getting emotional about my
I know.
Apology. Yeah, he's a good boy. You just have a stuffed nose. You're not crying.
No, but I'm feeling, because I mean, they are such fragile, amazing creatures, and they're, like you said, you know, they can get sat on or something can happen to them. And
yeah, you got to keep them, that's why, yeah, in the house and warm, and they like warm temperatures, and they're a tropical bird, I believe, or something, I don't
know. Yeah, from Australia, and I remember when we were in Australia. Like a few years ago, that was my greatest joy. There was looking around at because they have crazy, you know, parakeets of all, not just budgies, but different kinds of parakeets, like just flying around all over the place. And yeah, it's amazing.
Are there birds in Burning Daylight?
Crows. Ravens, crows.
What do they represent to you?
Well, they're just northern. They're in creatures of the north. And I am fascinated by crows. I mean, you probably heard, what was it, a Radiolab piece or This American Life or something about crows and how they can create tools. Which is a complex thing for a brain to be able to figure out. They can create tools to get food. So they fashion tools and they recognize people, and they can teach their offspring to then recognize you, and future generations will recognize.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't hear this.
Wow.
Yeah, they can do crazy stuff. It's really, they're fascinating. But I wasn't necessarily centered around birds or crows or anything in this, in Burning Daylight. It was more about sled dogs, which are kind of central. And they're very important to the north, I guess, you know.
Right. So, okay. So
or
dogs.
Formerly.
They're not as much now?
Well, no, because it used to be an absolute essential. It was the way of getting around. And then they invented... You know, it's like horses.
Right.
You know, used to be really important to us.
Right.
And now, and that was one of the things that was also so devastating to, like, Inuit communities, where the people would come in and, like, just kill all their dogs. And they're like, this is crazy. They're so connected to us and to our livelihood and how we live in the world, you know?
Yeah. We talked about... your fascination with spinsters and specific people that... who was it again you mentioned?
Oh, Marianne Moore.
Yeah, you mentioned Marianne Moore. We've been talking about Jack London. You have at least a history of taking an artist whose work you admire and then adapting it to your own, for your own purposes. Why do you suppose you gravitate towards that approach? Have you thought about that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I know that, like, with this most recent... The project that I'm currently working on with Sherry Boyle, we're doing a tour, actually, in Northwest Territories in 2 weeks or so. We're going to be going up and doing this crazy thing. And it was the first time in a really long time I did a series of writing that wasn't based around... another artist's work. It was working with Sherry, working with a living artist, you know, and collaborating that way. But I do love the idea of, I think that art is a conversation, and I love to have that conversation, whether or not it's with someone's work or whether if it's with another artist. For me, it's just a natural way that I like to make art in the world, or I find myself doing that. It's not so much mining my own feelings about stuff.
And
it's boring.
Do you articulate the influence out of due diligence and respect, or like if you had put this project out and didn't frame it around where the influence, because so many artists are influenced by so many things,
right.
And some of us will never know unless they do an interview and say, well, actually, like, it's not spelled out, but in the promotional material, Jack London's name is mentioned, you know, there's all this mention of the gold rush and Klondike, you know, the culture of the Yukon, I suppose, or the historical culture. And I'm just curious, did you think, like, what if I just put this out? What if I let people kind of draw their own conclusions? And
well, it was interesting because when we were putting it together as a book, which came later, the idea of doing it approaching it as a book, I started going, I returned to his writing and was kind of, I wanted to use some, you know, some epigraphs, and I was kind of approaching it again from a distance, I guess, and looking for that. And it was really like a lightning strike, because I'm one of those, I'll make something, I'm like, I can be so engaged in it and have read this piece and know it super well and then forget.
I
move on, it's gone.
Sure.
You know, it's gone. And so for me, returning to it, and it was like reaffirming to know that even though I don't remember a lot of the research process, that it's really contained in there and that it was really essential. So pulling out the work and showing the inspiration and showing his writing felt really like it was important.
Okay.
It was an important part of, to me, that's, and I don't know, it just seemed like the right thing to do.
I think the conversational aspect that you mentioned, or rather, like the conversational aspect, the kind of weird, it's temporally weird, but you're almost collaborating with these long gone people in a sense. You're kind of working together, whether they know it or not. And I think that's all well and good. I'm curious where that stems from. I want to ask you about your earliest days coming up with stuff, like coming up with artistic stuff. Were you always sort of like, that person did something interesting, I kind of think I can draw from that and have that conversation? Or was there a point where you were finding your voice and doing so independently of other factors?
Well, it's weird. When I grew up in Kelowna, on the Lake Okanagan there, and we were kind of, you know, it was back in, when I was growing up, there was nobody around there. It was pretty wild, and we'd just kind of run wild, and you'd come back home when the sun was going down. You were just left to our own devices. So for me, it was a lot of times, you know, just wandering around in nature by the lake and just spending a lot of time by myself, I guess. So not in a bad way. It was just, you were just out using your imagination all the time. But I remember, and it's funny because my friend's kid was at the book launch last night, and he was back. It's at Type Books, which is that wonderful bookstore on Queen there. And mm-hmm. he was back in the little kids section, and he was reading books, and apparently he just learned to read on his own, like actually yeah. read. And I had that flash, and I remembered that feeling of how amazing it was to see, because we used to sit after dinner, the whole family sit around, and everybody would read books. And before I could read, I would sit there with a book, and I'd look at everybody. And I'd look at the book, and I'd try to figure out what they were doing, like how they were getting that.
Yeah.
What was in there that they were getting. And it was like, I remember that feeling of suddenly understanding what it was that was, it was a real revelation to me. It was very, I remember it being more potent than even music, I think. You know, it was just that, how are they getting this? It's silent, it's internal, and I don't understand it.
Right.
Like, it's really...
That was your first spark? Like just...
Yeah.
Wow.
And I mean, we always had music in the house, and my grandfather was a musician, and my dad always had a drum kit everywhere we went. He was just, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know why. A drum kit and a punching bag. A heavy bag,
both,
you know? You
need both ways of, you know, getting rid of some frustration, I think. Yes. Drumming is the full body workout for musicians,
yeah.
I think. You're doing everything at the same time. And punching bag, obviously.
Yes, obviously.
Maybe he just was like, oh, it was a nice outlet.
It was pretty funny. I never thought about it until later. You know, when you realize that your friend's dads didn't do that, you're like, oh.
Did he play out, though? Did he play?
No. He played very in.
Was he good?
I don't know. He's probably all right. I think, you know, he's probably... He enjoyed himself.
What if he had a secret life as like a amazing jazz drummer or something?
Who knows? Well, I know my grandfather did, and he like that to his end of his days was like before he went to the war, he was playing in big bands. He had his own big band, you know, and these are all kids from the farm out in like rural Ontario that
right.
had no money, but they had got these instruments, and they were like gonna be like Benny Goodman, you know?
Right. yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
So that was your initial spark, and then, so how old were you?
I don't know. When do you learn to read? Like
14?
Yeah. No, six, seven, I guess. Like in that weird.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to teach my kid to read, and I don't know how to do it. He's got a great memory, so I think he's reading. I'm like, what does this say? And he'll just like, because we've read him the story so much, but it's to the word. And I'm like, are you reading or remembering right now?
Well, isn't that interesting? Because I think that is linked, that how you learn to read is like it's somewhere in that memory and recognition, because
absolutely they're connected. I don't trust my son. He tells a lot of lies.
He's a dirty liar
a little bit, but I'm just like, are you reading this? Like it's true. When you read something to him enough times, like I said to you, maybe I don't know if this was while we were eating, but like he's got a ridiculous memory for song lyrics, and he just remembers. Great memory. And you can't, because of that, unfortunately, we can't pull anything over on him.
Yeah.
He's just like, he's like a lawyer. It's like a little tiny like. But last time what you said was.
Does he quote you verbatim too? Is this verbatim? Uh-oh.
Yes.
That's
and he's
trouble.
Like, everything's very literal with a kid. Like, you can't be sarcastic, which is can be
they
tricky.
They don't get it.
Well, and it can be damaging. Like, it can be just like. Yeah, you have to be careful. Because did you ever want to have kids?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
No.
It was never a thing.
Okay.
But I sure appreciate, like, my sister has kids, and I really enjoy the process of having family humans that came from small to big.
I think you'd find a lot of inspiration there for stuff. Like, there's just...
That's what I've heard people say. My ship has sailed, though.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying...
It's too late, Vish.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to get into
Can I have
that.
One of yours? I hear you got, like, an extra one.
There's another one coming, yeah. No, it's just interesting how inspiring they can be. Like, they just... You kind of start to revisit your life... Relive your life when you have a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're just, like... But earlier, anyway, you're at a point where, you're like, you have no recollection of being a tiny baby. But at some point,
right.
you start to read them alligator pie or whatever you found interesting when you were a kid. And you're like, whoa, weird. I can't believe I read this when I was a kid. Like, this is really dark or whatever. And anyway, but you are just, like, revisiting your youth by having a kid.
Oh, and that's a lovely way of looking at it. Because, it's interesting just, watching a lot of our friends having kids and seeing how the experience is so, mm-hmm. you know, because you're trying to,
And we're all making it up as we go along. Parents said to my parents-in-law, my parents-in-law from Alberta came during the birth of our first son. Well, they
were they in there with you, like
no,
and that?
We did it in the house. Like, we had midwives, so they were around, but no, they split for the actual birth because they thought they should, and I didn't. That's probably what they should have done. But
yeah.
But at the same time, my parents said to them, like a few days after the birth, like, "Thank God you came. We didn't know what we were doing when Vishal was born." Like, they, like, my parents are, we're at a point where, like, my parents have to babysit Levon, but I don't think my parents are fit to raise children. I really don't. Or look after them. Like, I just don't think it makes any sense.
Yeah.
They don't know what they're, anyway, I feel bad.
It's a miracle that you are here today.
I don't know. Television was my surrogate parent, really. And it kind of comes out. David Letterman and Grover. Is what really raised me. Johnny Carson, in a weird way. Anyway, so your interest in music was sparked just because it was in the house?
Well, we had a piano, you know, my dad had a drum kit, guitar,
and
stuff
you
like that.
And you tootle around on those?
Well, I used to write songs, using air quotes when I say that, but I remember wanting to do that, and I would write them with the notes, because I took piano lessons, so I knew what the notes were, and I would draw and make songs and write them down, and they had lyrics and stuff.
Oh,
but
wow.
It was more like a art project. I don't think it was necessarily a brilliant musical genius at work. I was not like Mozart. I was not a prodigy.
Right.
I was just kind of, because I came to music even late, like as a job, you know.
But did you have any? You had some training, obviously.
A little bit, yeah.
You did,
but
some
I don't
lessons?
Really.
Yeah.
And I did. I went to Humber for a year. Went to the jazz program. The year that I went to Humber College was the year they outlawed smoking.
Oh, no.
In the classrooms.
Oh.
I think you could still do it in the halls.
You could smoke in the classroom?
Yeah, they had ashtrays on all the desks.
Ooh.
And
sorry, that's gross. Were you a smoker?
I don't think I was. But I just remember all of the teachers and students, everybody was just like, this is outrageous. This will never last. Like, they'll never be able to make this. Like, people just couldn't believe that it was, it was not even outrage. It was just disbelief. This will never last.
Yeah. And it didn't.
It didn't take
no,
it
no. So you did the Humber thing. The Humber, for those who don't know, this is like a college in Toronto.
Yeah. North. Well, I went to the North Campus.
Like kind of near
Malton.
Yeah. Malton. Right. But it's got a weird reputation because, like, people come out of there and they're usually really slick, shit-hot players, but they're, like, technical kind of players. I don't know how to put this. It just seems like
it's
very professional.
Well, and it is weird, and I think that's an interesting thing that I'm coming to right now, because I am now teaching. John and I teach at UBC in the creative writing department.
Right.
And we teach the online MFA program there in the creative writing, and we have a songwriting
Oh, nice.
Course, but it's through creative writing. It's not through music, which I think is sort of the key.
Mm-hmm.
Because neither John nor I came to music or songwriting or writing from an academic perspective, but I'm recognizing that there is a place for that and that it can be. We're using kind of like the Iowa Writers Workshop model, where it's most of it is coming from the students themselves, and you're just, it's the idea of conversation. Art is conversation. So,
right.
And just, I think now in retrospect, I wish that I had had something like that, because it's certainly the kind of training that you're getting to be a technical player like that isn't necessarily the conversation part of it. It's like, jazz is a conversation. You listen to jazz music, it's a conversation. It's not, you're not taking solos.
Yeah.
You're talking to each other,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
And so it's just a weird shift if you're trying to teach it as an academic field.
Yeah.
It's like a show, not tell, you know, kind of thing.
Did you go to school? Did you go to university and stuff?
Did you go
to No, well, we talked about, sorry. I just put it, I meant, we already established that you had sort of minimal musical training.
Yes.
But did you go to like
I went
English
to University of Guelph for...
How many years?
I think I did 2 years and I stopped, so I'm partway through an undergrad.
I knew this. We talked about this when you were in Guelph recently.
Yeah.
Well, years ago now.
I know.
2 years of undergrad in what program?
I was sort of like, I had just whatever. But
general arts, yeah.
Philosophy. I liked the philosophy department a lot when I was there, and the English department. So I was taking mostly, and I don't remember who the names of the professors, but they were fantastic. And I just was, it wasn't for me.
But your songwriting is so great. I mean, I don't want to, you know, make you uncomfortable, but I really love your songwriting. It's very distinctive, and you know, you're a great storyteller. This is just an organic. This is organic output, so to speak. Like, this is not something you were kind of trained to do.
Well, and I wonder, can we... that's what I mean, I think certain people thrive in an academic setting, and I think there's so much value to that, and maybe even more so now, because we've maybe figured it out a little bit more, although I've noticed just as an observer and as a university, we're just adjunct faculty... But there's just that is the thing that concerns me right now is this, all these sessional type people coming in and they're not getting well paid. They're professionals in their field, many of whom, unlike me, have actual educations that they spent many years and a lot of dough making that happen. And that there aren't just very many people that are being academics as a profession anymore,
which is,
I think we need those people.
Well, I think it's being weeded out purposefully.
Yeah, yeah. Well, certainly.
I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I think that everything that's happening in sort of cultural production, and I count academia, aspects of academia around that, I think it's just being very insidiously and subtly destroyed. And I think it's finally being noticed by people, but certainly...
Because we always notice it when it's at its most dramatic, like you're... looking at it like, oh, you see all the...
I feel like the cutting, though, has been so gradual,
right,
in the sense that it was very smart. It wasn't just like, we're going to go in and cut all this stuff. It was like, little by little, incrementally by incrementally, we have a 10-year plan as to how we're going to... And so it seems soft, and it puts a lot of people in limbo. Just like, you talk to people who work in cultural production sectors, and they'll just like, how are things going? Well, you know, we're hanging on. We're just waiting and seeing... A lot of people are just waiting for something to shift or to be finally told that they're not doing the thing they're doing anymore. That must be awful, that limbo. Yeah. So, anyway, I don't know why we're talking about this, but...
I steered it there.
You did.
I'm sorry. No. I didn't mean to. Just because we were talking about academics, and I think there's so much value in it, and I don't want to be the person that says, I didn't get an education, and I turned out great. You know, it's like, I had a lot of other things going for me that... I didn't
Clearly.
Need to do that.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I mean? Like, I live in a first world country, and I was growing up at a time when there were jobs. Like, I could actually get a job.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, no,
you know?
It's fair.
It's different time.
Now, you did you meet John through musical sort of circumstances?
Through mutual friends. I had actually, when I met him, I had never heard his music before.
Oh, he was already making... songs and
I met him I think it was early on in Weaker Thans, maybe they'd made one record
okay
and And I remember hearing it and kind of going, that's okay. But...
which is fair. I know a few people who are more discerning and honest than you, which is great. It's funny. Because he's written these really loving, like, open songs. Like, he's got a song that's about you and
I know.
That interaction.
It's about, could be about you, though, couldn't it? Could be about anybody.
No, I think it's about you. I just think it's about you. But yeah, it's just this, maybe it's not. It's a protagonist. Who knows? I don't know. But it seems to be about you. Anyway, and he kind of really captured you in a way. What song am I thinking of? I can't think of the name of that song.
Just swearing in it.
In the title?
I think just in the song. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, you tell me to F off.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the song. Why don't we remember? You should know the name of the goddamn song.
I don't know. I don't listen to that music. You're not allowed to sit at home and listen to each other's records.
No,
that's the drag, actually.
Didn't you used to do a thing where you would each sort of have writing competitions?
Competitions, yes. Like competitions are excellent for art production.
No, where it wasn't like a little sort of quiet challenge to each
well,
other?
Well, we do, yeah. We still periodically do that. It's in a less sort of formulaic, more like, okay, we've been commissioned to do this thing, so we have to do
it. Oh, okay. Right.
Not necessarily. We don't have the luxury of time like we used to.
But you might have input into, like, if you were putting out a Christine Fellows record, he's working on John K. Samson or Weaker Than stuff, you're having input in...
Oh, absolutely. We're almost to the point where we consider ourselves one brain, because he's got, he has skills and... that I don't, and you know, he's
vice
whatever
versa.
He's amazing. He's an amazing writer and actually a really great editor
yeah.
in a lot of ways, and so we're brutally honest with each other, and everything kind of goes through the, you know, we're just there for
no
each
it makes
other.
Sense
yeah
you get
he
two.
Works upstairs, I work downstairs,
and then you kind of go up and downstairs and be like, what do you think of this, and
we email each other.
Email each other the, that makes sense.
You come down here, help me with this thing,
the modern intercom.
yeah
No, that's good. Okay, so I'm just curious, what's next for you? We've sort of touched upon, sorry, this was a little fractured, we ate our food, we talked about,
I know, sorry,
no.
It is me, it's I'm
no,
on
it's
a cold
you.
Medication and
no I we talked about budgies and we talked about good stuff, but hopefully people have a little sense of Burning Daylight now, which is what we're ostensibly supposed to talk about. I guess I didn't really ask you about why you thought to explore this avenue of a book that complements a record. That's a bit new.
Well, it was kind of, it actually was a lot of, it was John's idea in a weird sort of way. I was really, I had recorded the album was done, and I had always had the vision that that album would be adapted for the stage in some way. Mm. And I was, in fact, working with a wonderful choreographer, Lysandra Dodson. Do you know her? She used to live here in Toronto. She's lived in Winnipeg. She's one of my all-time favorite artists. She's an extraordinary artist. And I really, I wanted her to take this on, and we were kind of working toward it, and it just, it turned out that it was just harder to make it happen than in this, like we were just talking about things being clawed back. Theater, it's not a great time to try to put on a theater, make a theater piece that has a six-person cast
yeah.
for touring. And,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
So I was sitting there with this project sort of half done and going, I know it's something else. It's not just...
It's not just a record.
It's not just a record.
Yeah.
What is it? And then I just sort of put it away for a minute, and I had this incredible opportunity last fall to go up to Nunavut and... Just as a, I was working as a sound designer and record, like the guy doing the sound, which I don't normally do, like for this project up in Iqaluit. And it was with my friend Alicia Smith, mm-hmm. who is an NFB National Film Board producer. And so it was, we were up there with a crew and had this kind of life altering. I don't know if you've traveled up in the north at all, but.
I've been to. It's funny you say that, because I was just going to ask if there was... You have probably been to every province and territory in this country now.
Labrador.
I
haven't, but even though I know it's Newfoundland and Labrador, I haven't been to Labrador.
Damn it, that might be me too. I like to say that the only place I haven't been is Nunavut. I like to say that to anyone. I put it on my business card. The only place I've never been is Nunavut, and I want to go.
Yeah.
I just don't know how to do it.
I know, it's insanely expensive.
Yeah.
I learned later what that.
But I've been flown up to, I've been to Yellowknife, and I've been flown up to Dawson City. I got flown out to the Dawson City Music Festival, so I got to check, and I stayed in Whitehorse, and walked around and stuff and loved Dawson City. So yeah, I've been to the areas. Yellowknife, I was there a week and it was cool.
Amazing.
But yeah, sorry, but I haven't been to Nunavut.
Well, hopefully, it is interesting because when you suddenly go up there and you have the perspective of where it is in Canada, it's a huge part of the, it's huge.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on up there, and especially artistically and culturally, like it's like a foreign land. I was in Iceland this spring or summer, I guess, and it felt very much like there was a relationship between those places. They've created their own culture. There's mm-hmm. like, it's its own thing up there.
Yeah.
It's very distinct from Northwest Territories or Yukon, even like as the North is. It's really specific.
Right.
But I loved that specificity of it. But it's also, you know, changing so more rapidly than anywhere else because of the Northwest Passage just opened up in 2013.
Oh, okay.
Which is huge. And that will affect people. That's going right through Nunavut. And there's going to be big shipping going through there, and these are like traditional fishing places where fishing and hunting and just huge mega mining projects and stuff up on Baffin Island. It's just happening
right now.
Was
it happening when you were there?
It was being they were starting to build the railway in the Baffin Land to the Baffin Land mining, and just already, you know, the things that happened in the 60s of like forcing the Inuit people to live in settlements when they're not, they don't live, that's not traditionally how, didn't make sense.
Right.
You know, all of this stuff is sort of coming out from that. And I felt like when I was there and seeing how mining is affecting that place, and then going to, having been to Dawson and seeing even the resurgence of the gold mining is now in currently going on, and just these two, they seem to really relate to each other to me. I don't know, in completely different ways, but it is Canada,
right.
You know. So to me, then I started just writing poems. I wasn't writing songs; I was writing poems, and I couldn't stop. And now there's a
poetry
book.
Now
they're together.
Nice. Well, that's great. That must be exciting for you to explore a new world. And
yeah, poetry. Who knew? Poets have more fun.
Poets have a lot of fun, I think.
I think they do. I'm hoping. Yeah. I did, you know, my first reading, and I think it went all right.
I can't wait to read the poetry book. That's very exciting. I'm glad you did this.
Well, I got a book for you here, Albert.
Oh, that's very cool. Yeah. That's great. Look, I asked for something, and I got it. That's great. I wasn't just fishing for a book. I really can't wait to read it.
Cool. You're nice.
I am nice. Try to be nice. So anything coming up next for you that you mentioned that you're doing this tour?
Yeah, so we've got a new Sherry and I who I've been working with her for years now, but we've finally done a thing that it's just the two of us. We've made a show and it's from the ground up, all new art, all new music, and we've...
Oh, that's a whole other... Okay.
Right. We've made a whole new thing. So we're starting that. We'll be touring a lot in the year to come, in the next year. Maybe we'll come out here. There's talk.
That'd be great. And the book is out on which press?
ARP.
Which is?
John Sampson's.
He's
currently the managing editor, but now is stepping down after many years of doing that job.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's out, and then the record comes with the book?
Yep.
You get the book with the record and done.
There's a CD in it, but there's a download code for people that live in the future.
Okay, that's great. So it's all out on ARP.
Yeah.
And then anything beyond this? So you can't think beyond?
No, I think they have that thing in the touring shows probably. I have a whole new record written, so we'll see. I've kind of been doing this thing because Jason Tate, the drummer for the Weaker Thans, just moved to Winnipeg a year ago.
Yeah.
And I've started playing with him again. We used to play a lot before he moved and even when he lived here in Toronto. And so I'm curious about that, about working with him again.
Cool.
He's a wonderful musician and I love drums, and the last record had no drums, so like maybe I want to play with some drums.
I think you should play with some drums again.
So great.
It's fun.
It's the best instrument.
I like playing drums.
I know. You're
it's fun playing
You and Giongo Meshi.
Yes. So similar. Anyway, that's a nice way to end. thank you for being on the show and for bringing me to this place. What's it called again? Milagro?
Yeah, I know. I think we should have a margarita now before we go.
I don't know if I can do that, but I appreciate the offer. Is there another song we can play from Burning Daylight?
Ah, why don't we do... it's here. It's the my first sort of foray into spoken word, although it's not my own words that I'm speaking. It's called The Gold Seekers, and it's this guy, Hamlin Garland.
Yeah.
And he was a poet writing at the time of Jack London, around that time. And so I adapted a piece of his work and kind of changed the pronoun from male to female and had a little bit of fun. And Ford Pier arranged it. The wonderful,
nice.
Brilliant Ford Pier. Yeah, so it's bonkers.
All right, let's hear it. Christine, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Vish.
It's so nice seeing you.
And nice
I'm,
to see you.
I'm glad you're having fun, doing stuff.
Hey, eat doggies.
Oh, yeah, and good luck with Pickles.
Thanks.
He's going to be great.
I saw these dreamers of dreams go by. I trod in their footsteps a space. Each marched with her eyes on the sky. Each passed with a light on her face. They came from the hopeless and sad. They faced the future in gold. Some the tooth of once wolf had made mad, and some at the forge had grown old. The light will fade from each eye, the smile from each face. They will curse the impassable sky and the earth when the snow torrents race. Some will sink by the way. And some will return to a maid, empty of hand as at birth.
Hey, thanks again for checking out Creative Control with Vish Khanna. You can email me about the show at creativecontrol933@gmail.com. That's creative with a K, control with a K, 933@gmail.com. You can also follow our Twitter at Vish Creative, VishKreative. And you can also like our Facebook page. A version of this show airs on CFRU in Guelph every Wednesday at noon Eastern. And you can listen to that online at CFRU.ca, or if you're in the KW region at 93.3 FM in Guelph. You can also sign up for the weekly mailing list for the podcast and the show at vishkhanna.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I believe that is everything I wanted to tell you. Thank you once again.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.